All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday morning, May 10th, 11:10 a.m. And we're going to pick it up kind of right where we left off. So today, we're going to take a look at, we've been doing these electrophilic addition reactions to alkenes, right? And so here in this example, this is at the end of the slide from last time. We have an alkene that's undergoing this reaction, and the three different products that we can make. And what we're looking at is that alkene, when reacting with HCl, we can get the chlorine going out on the primary end. That's only 3% of the product. We can get the chlorine going onto the secondary position. That's 37% of the product. And then the carbocation rearrangement gives us the 60%, where the chlorine winds up on a tertiary position because of the stability of the carbocation that's there. And what we've said is that if we run the reaction as normal, we can get that rearranged product. If we don't want the rearranged product, we can run the reaction with mercury acetate, which changes the reaction mechanism and goes through the cyclic mercurium ion and prevents the carbocation shift. But then, is there a way that we could get the chloride out on the primary end? And that becomes the question. So what we'd like to be able to do is we'd like to be able to push this thing to any of these three directions that we would want. And the way that we sort of draw that, let me create a new thing here for our lecture today. The way that we would normally draw that is to say, starting from an alkene, what we would like to be able to do is we would like to be able to add something like HX and be able to get it with X in this position. We would like to be able to do one mercury acetate, HgOAC2. And then in addition to that, we add in the nucleophile that we want as an anion. That allows us to do this, and there are no carbocation shifts. Up here, we would say shifts possible. And then the other question, though, is there a way to be able to get the mechanism such that we can put X out in that position? And how do we achieve that? Because we know that this mechanism is governed by the formation of the carbocation. So as soon as this thing grabs the H, the proton, the hydrogen ion, it grabs it in such a way that the carbocation that forms is the most stable carbocation. And that's going to have a lower activation energy. And so what can we do in order to change that reactivity and make that different? Well, we can't do anything to the carbocation directly. We have to do something a little bit different. And this is where we need to take some observations from other reactions that have happened and then see what we can do with it. And this was an idea that that was found by H.C. Brown. And H.C. Brown worked with a compound called borane and diborane. Diborane is a dimer of BH3, borane. So this is borane here. Borane is a trigonal planar molecule. It is a boron that only has three valence electrons. And having three valence electrons, when it makes compounds, it only has the three valence electrons to use. And so it is trigonal planar and does not have an octet. It only has six valence electrons. So it's electron deficient. And that means that when we look at borane, that borane is isoelectronic with a carbocation. It has an empty p orbital and is extremely electron deficient. In addition, so we're saying this is sort of equivalent to a carbocation in that the carbocation has the empty p orbital. And that these things are extremely electron deficient. So they're electron hungry. In addition to that, the electronegativity of boron is such that it is less electronegative than carbon. The electronegativity on boron is about 2.0. So when we look at the boron electronegativity and carbon electronegativity, this is 2.0. Carbon's 2.5, hydrogen is approximately 2.2 something. And so when you look at the carbon-hydrogen bond, the polarity is such that the hydrogen is partial positive, I drew the arrow in the wrong direction, and the carbon is partial minus. And the polarity runs that way. But when you look at the boron-carbon or boron-hydrogen bond, the polarity runs the opposite direction. Hydrogen takes on the partial minus, and boron takes on the partial positive. In order to stabilize itself, borane, BH3, dimerizes. And becomes diborane. Diborane is a really interesting compound in that it I should do it this way. Let me redraw that a little bit. Let's do it this way. And then I'll do back and I'll do forward. That'll work. Back and forward. So this is diborane. And the question is, what is the nature of this bond that is the hydrogen bond that goes to both borons? And the nature of that bond is that it is a what we call a three-center two-electron bond. It's like a hydrogen bond. But when we think about a hydrogen bond, we generally think of something like this. We generally think of R, O, H, and then the hydrogen bond to another oxygen, which has an O and an R. And the reason that this hydrogen bond works is because that hydrogen is super electron deficient, and the oxygen here is super electron rich. And so the donation goes from the oxygen to the hydrogen. But in this three-center two-electron bond that is within the boron like this, the polarities are different. The hydrogen is partial minus, and the boron is partial positive, and the electron-rich thing is the hydrogen, and it is back-donating to the boron. So the hydrogen is the thing that is actually electron-rich. Okay, so to use diborane, it's really hard to use as a gas. So this thing here exists as a gas. And in order to get it into solution and to break up the diborane, what they do is they take diborane and they react it with THF, tetrahydrofuran. And what that does is the electrons on the oxygen of the tetrahydrofuran occupy the empty p orbital of the boron and they split this complex up. So what happens is they add to this THF. This THF breaks this up, and there's two of these. And what we make is we make boron. The oxygen binds to the boron in the empty p orbital. And then this becomes tetrahedral, and you're making two equivalents of this. This is called BH3THF. And this has a partial minus and a partial positive. And we usually write it this way, BH3.THF. This now can go and do what's called hydroboration. So hydroboration is a reaction between an alkene and BH3 or BH3THF. And the way that it works is that when we have a double bond and we have some group over here, that the boron and the hydrogen add to the double bond. And what happens is because of the empty p orbital that's here, this thing is a strong electrophile. So this is following with our electrophilic addition to double bonds. The double bond reaches out and the electrons go into the empty p orbital of the boron. The boron simultaneously lets go of the electrons that are here. These electrons break and these electrons go back to the carbon. And the transition state for this, when we look at this transition state, it looks like this. We get a forming double bond between the boron and the carbon. We get a breaking bond between the hydrogen and the boron, and a forming bond between the carbon and the hydrogen. These guys are still attached. And what I have is a buildup of a partial positive charge in the center there. And I'm getting a buildup of a partial minus charge that is happening on the boron over here as that hydrogen is transferring over. And it is an asymmetric transition state. What is happening is the bond over here, this part, is more developed. So we would say that this is bond making with the boron is happening slightly ahead of bond making of the hydrogen. And because of that, it's this development of positive charge right here that draws the transition state. So when we think about this going in two different directions, in other words, if I think about what could happen if the boron were to go the other direction, the alternative is that when I look at the double bond formation, if the boron is going this direction and the hydrogen this way, and the bond making happens with the boron earlier than the bond making with the hydrogen, then I would get the partial positive developing out here, the partial minus at the carbon, at the boron. And we can now compare these two transition states. And it's really about looking at where this partial positive is developing. So do I want that partial positive at the secondary center, at the more substituted center, or do I want that partial positive at the primary center? And the answer is, of course, we know carbocation stability, that a carbocation is more stable where it's more substituted, where it gets more electron donation. And so this one is far more stable than having this on the primary. And so what we say is that this transition state is more stable, lower activation energy, with partial positive on more substituted position.
This one is less stable. This is a higher activation. Partial positive on less substituted. So even though we're talking about partial positives instead of full carbocations, the same principle applies. We want the buildup of charge in the most stable position. Whether that's a full charge or a partial charge, makes no difference. That's what we're actually looking at. And so what happens is that buildup of charge, as it pushes the partial positive towards the carbon with more stable, the boron is going to wind up attached to the primary position. And so what we see is that when we look at this reaction and we go through and we do the hydroboration, that the boron is going to end up here, the hydrogen here. We go through and we bind this way and this way. It breaks down and the hydrogen has attached and the boron has attached in these two positions. And you say, well, that's great. What does that do for us? Well, what it does for us is it followed Makarnikov's rule. It did the addition where the boron added to the less substituted side, the hydrogen added to the more substituted side. But what it did is it went through a carbocation that was the most stable carbocation. Now what we can do is we can take this product and we can do a second reaction. We can do what's called oxidation. And the oxidation replaces the boron with a hydroxyl group. And so I need to show you how that oxidation works. But what it does is it gives us a substitution pattern where we now have access, and let's see if I went back here, we now have access to putting a group on the less substituted position rather than the more substituted positions that we had with HX or using mercury acetate, that now we have a way of going through and getting a hydroxyl group here. We could find out how to get a chloride there or a bromide there or other groups there. There's other things that we can do. We have to wait for a little bit more chemistry to do that. But now we have access to being able to actually make this thing. And I need to go through a little bit more of the mechanism here because it's a little bit more interesting in what happens with this oxidation and what happens with this guy. This, by the way, was Nobel Prize winning work for H.C. Brown. H.C. Brown won the Nobel Prize, I believe it was in the 1960s for his work. Yeah, 1956, not 1960s, 1950s, for what is called hydroboration oxidation to put a substituent on the less substituted carbon. And this had been a goal of organic chemistry for a long time, and H.C. Brown solved that problem. So, to go through this just a little bit more and to show kind of what happens, this part is the interesting part right here, is that when I look at the boron, it still has two hydrogens on it. And each one of those hydrogens can go forward and can react. And so what we see happening is that this boron will react not with one equivalent of double bond, but it will go on and it'll react with the first equivalent, the second equivalent, and the third equivalent. It'll react with all three equivalents of the double bond. So here's sort of the full mechanism. It takes a little bit to work it out. Mechanism, hydroboration, oxidation. And what we'll do is as we go through this mechanism, I'm going to shortcut it a little bit to specific steps that we really want to look at. So what we do is we take a double bond. Let's make it an asymmetric double bond. We react it with BH3THF. In the mechanism, what's happening is the boron adds ahead of the hydrogen. so that the double bond reaches out, grabs the boron, the hydrogen swings back and attaches to the carbon. The hydrogen attaches there, the boron here. And then this undergoes another reaction with another alkene. And again, the double bond goes to the boron, the hydrogen goes to the carbon, and this keeps going on as the boron is making these new bonds with these alkyl groups. We have one more hydrogen yet. That does another step where the double bond reacts with that hydrogen. And so this grabs the boron. The hydrogen's electrons bind to the alkyl group. And we create what is called a trialkyl borane. So this is the trialkyl borane. At this point, the reaction is done. And the boron has reacted with all of the double bond that it can. At this point, they introduce the second step. So this makes the, what we would say is B, we could say R3, essentially, because that's the trialkyl borane. Then in the second step, what we do is the oxidation. And we do that with sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. These are oxidation conditions that oxidize the trialkyl borane. And this is the really cool part, because now what happens is the boron still has that empty p orbital. It's still trigonal planar. And the hydrogen peroxide reacts with the hydroxide to make the peroxy anion. So this is the peroxy anion, and that peroxy anion binds to that empty p orbital. The boron now looks like this. It has these three alkyl groups attached, and they are in a tetrahedral arrangement. And the boron has a negative charge. The boron now has an octet, but when it does, it gets a formal negative charge, and it really doesn't want that formal negative charge. It's very hard for that small element to hang on to that negative charge, and the steric crowding around the small boron element is fairly large. And so to relieve that high energy of having the negative charge and the sterics that are around it, this molecule breaks down. And the way it does is it breaks down by migrating one of the R groups. The electrons that are in this bond break, and they come over here and they bind to the oxygen, which kicks out a leaving group. This bond breaks, and these electrons go with that oxygen. And so this whole thing breaks down, and it becomes B. The oxygen is still here, but I have a new bond that is attached to the R group. The hydroxide has left, and it was a leaving group. And I still have the other two R groups attached to the boron. This goes on and repeats itself two more times. So what happens is another peroxy anion comes in, because I've added a lot of equivalents of this peroxy anion. It comes in and it binds to the boron. And this goes through that same mechanism two more times. So I'm going to say just here two more times rather than trying to draw it all out. And what we end up with at the end of this is a molecule that is the trialkoxyborane. Now, each one of these molecules is bound to the boron through its oxygen. And the hydrogen that was added from the boron is sitting in these locations. So that's where the double bond was broken, and that's where the hydrogen added, just to track where that hydrogen adds. Okay, now what happens to these is the key thing with that hydroxide and the water. Now what happens is hydroxide comes in, and this could happen in any of these other intermediate steps as well. The hydroxide comes in and binds to the boron's empty p orbital. And this mechanism isn't necessary to go through and do the reaction, but it's nice to see and kind of know where everything sits and goes. So here's the hydroxyl group. And I'll put in the trialkoxy groups. Now there's nothing else that can migrate. There's no other way for this boron to relieve that negative charge other than through letting go of one of the oxygens. And that's exactly what it does, is this thing lets go of one of the oxygens. Which is then going to pick up an electron from the solvent, from the water in the solvent. And so this guy that just came off as a leaving group, let's see, that's the R group. Okay, this guy picks up from the water that's in solution, that was part of the solvent system that we added. It picks up a proton from the water, which creates hydroxide. Okay, if we go through that system and we go through that two more times, the ultimate fate of the reaction is that boron converts to having three hydroxyl groups on it. This is boric acid. This is non-toxic. It's used as a laundry detergent, 20-mule borax laundry detergent. It's used as a soap. It's used as an eye wash because it's so mild. It is used as an ant killer because of its ability to dehydrate things. And so as a solid, boric acid can be used to dehydrate, and it will lace ant food with boric acid to act as an ant poison through dehydration. So it has many different uses for boric acid, but to humans on small scale, it's non-toxic. The other thing that gets created is we get three equivalents of the alcohol that is attached with the substitution pattern that puts the hydroxyl group on the less substituted carbon. And that's the overall mechanism of the oxidation component and the hydroboration component. And so it is these reactions that happen over and over again with boron, where each reaction happens three times. So we start with three equivalents of hydrogen, we get three additions to the double bond. Once we get there, we do the second step of sodium hydroxide, which then works with hydrogen peroxide to then make this species, and a migration that happens of the alkyl group that goes to the trialkoxyborane. And then that dissociates using hydroxy groups and water to become the alcohol and the boric acid. And that's the whole breakdown in where that thing goes. So the way that we write these reactions is we write these reactions like this. So let's say that we have a double bond here like this. We would write the reaction as one hydroboration, BH3.THF. And we always write it with the THF because it's part of the molecule. the molecule BH3 exists as a gas and doesn't really function unless it's dissolved in THF or some other ether solvent. So we always write BH3 THF. THF is the most common ether solvent that is used for this. Second thing we write is we write the oxidation as sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. This would go to the product that would have the alcohol on the terminal end and does so in something close to 98%. And that's the hydroboration oxidation reaction. And so we could look at a number of different substrates. One of the substrates that we were doing before was this substrate. We can now do the same reaction, 1-BH3-THF. We can do 2-sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. The order that you write the three reagents here, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water, the order can be switched. It really doesn't matter. This is the most common order that you see them written in. And we would automatically know that the hydroxyl group is going to go on the least substituted carbon. And that's how it's going to work. Okay, so this leads me to some other questions, though, as we start to look at hydroboration oxidation. There's some other interesting facets of this that we want to understand. Let's take a look at this reaction. We'll see as we go through this that we're going to find a couple of different questions that we're going to want to seek answers to. Let's do 1-BH3-THF. Oxidation, and the key thing here to do is to look at this and to look at the two centers and to decide about the two centers of the double bond as to what those two centers are. This one is a tertiary center, essentially. It has three different groups that are attached to it. The one over on this side is a secondary center. It has less groups attached. This reaction, when this reaction goes forward, the boron is going to want to put the partial positive on the more substituted carbon. So ideally, what we're going to see is that we're going to see partial positive develop on this side, and we're going to see the boron attached to this side. Wherever the boron goes, that's where the oxygen is going to show up at the end of the reaction. So when we run this reaction, what we're going to see is that the hydrogen is going to show up on that carbon. The oxygen, after oxidation with the boron, is going to show up on that one. And we don't sit and draw these mechanisms out all the time. We know the mechanism of the reaction, and if there's any question as to where things are going, what we do is we identify where the most stable partial positive is, and then the boron goes on the other one. Okay, so we get this product. We could also say that we do get the other product, and I want to show the product ratios because we can get some of this. This one would be the major. This one would be the minor. And the product ratios that we see are pretty much in favor, 98 and 2. So this is 98% and 2%. Okay. Let's take a look at doing this on a molecule that that has some different things going on. Let's do it on this guy. Number one, BH3.THF. Number two, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. Okay, so now we look at these two centers, and we can look at that center and that center of the double bond. And this guy here is a secondary, and this guy here is a secondary. You go, oh, that's interesting. So where's the boron going to go, and where's the partial positive more stable? Well, they're both secondary, and alkyl groups, regardless of their length, have equal stability that they grant to carbocations. They donate about the same, regardless of substitution, regardless of the size of the alkyl group. The size of the alkyl group really doesn't matter. So out of the two products that I see that I can get out of this, when I look at these two products, I get a product where the hydroxyl group goes into this position, and I get a product where the hydroxyl group will go to the other side. I'll draw it in the downwards position because that's a little bit easier to see the product. I'll track the two bonds that I'm looking at. So that was that position there. There's the other position. And what we see in these two is that we get about 57%. And 43%. And the question then is, why aren't they 50-50? That's the question. There's some reason why one of these was a major. And it was major by only a few percent. It was really major only about 3 extra percent. But this is what H.C. Brown does, and he does best, what he did best. Sadly, H.C. Brown is no longer with us. What H.C. Brown saw in this was that there was a preference for this hydroxide to go, or for the boron to go, onto the right-hand carbon. And what H.C. Brown noticed was that in the two transition states, in the two possible ways in which this reaction can work, if I think about this double bond as being predominantly flat, that while it is predominantly flat, it has a tetrahedral center that is this center over here. And that there is free rotation about this sigma bond. And that when the boron comes in to bind to this center, that the boron has to do this. The electrons have to go that way and that way. And what that does is that creates a transition state where that boron is being affected by that tetrahedral center, and that it's presenting some sterics. And those sterics are changing the reaction slightly. And it's these sterics that are here that I'm concerned about. So this is the transition state, and I'm getting partial minus and partial positive buildup. There's a hydrogen that's there. And it's those sterics that I'm worried about. And that when the boron reacts on the other side of the molecule, it has less sterics. Now, those sterics aren't great because the difference between the boron reacting with that methyl and this isopropyl group on the backside is not huge. So the electrons are coming in, those electrons are coming in, and this one is going through a similar transition state. We'll draw the same sort of idea here that the boron is slightly ahead of the hydrogen. And then I'm getting the buildup of partial positive, partial minus. It's transitioning the carbons to becoming tetrahedral. And on this transition state, there are lower sterics. So that's what we're seeing in here, is that these sterics are just a lot smaller between the methyl and the group there. So what I'm highlighting, what I'm really watching, is I'm watching this group, which is tetrahedral, and the boron, and the sterics that are interacting there. And over here on this one, yes, I've got a little bit of sterics from that methyl, but a lot less than I have on the other side. So this is lower energy and major. How much more major was it? It was 3% more major in terms of it. And if I want to align this really with what's going on down below, then to align it in the way that I drew the structures below, I could align it this way. 43%, get back over there. Okay, so now they're aligned with their reactions below as I'm drawing those transition states and why they're happening. And so this one being major was only a few percent major, a few percent more. But what H.C. Brown did is he realized he could turn that 3% extra into a massive extra if he could increase the sterics. All he needed to do was increase the sterics over here, and it would push this one to being much more favorable. So if you want to increase the sterics, you can't really just increase the substrate sterics, because that's not really changing the reaction. What you need to do is you need to change the boron. And that's what H.C. Brown did. So H.C. Brown looked at this and said, all right, I need to increase sterics. So how do I do that? And what H.C. Brown did is he did this. He took a molecule, which was a really big molecule, cyclooctadiene. It is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It is 1,5 cyclooctadiene. And he hydroborated this, BH3THF. Did not do the oxidation step, just reacted it with the boron itself. And what the boron did is the boron stepwise added, and the number of equivalents that he added was one equivalent to one equivalent. And so what wound up happening is the boron first adds to one side of the molecule. And you wind up getting this guy, BH2, with the double bond over here and the hydrogen added that way. Then the boron turns around and reacts with this double bond. Actually, the double bond is what's reaching out to the boron. And it reacts this way. So the boron is now sitting here. And it reaches over and makes a bond to that carbon over there. And the hydrogen is here, and the hydrogen is here, and there's one more hydrogen here. And now the reaction stops. Now, this molecule, when we draw it this way, is a little hard to see what's happening. So there's another way that's a little bit more convenient to draw it. I'm going to draw these three hydrogens and just track them real quick so that we see where each of the hydrogens are going. So there's all three hydrogens. This molecule assumes a conformation that looks like this. It's a boron that is bound across two molecules that are bound together like that. And in fact, when I draw it, I typically like to draw it this way. Let's see if I can do it the right way. This one just a little bit shorter. And what that is it's basically a bicyclic ring system where the boron is attached to two different ring systems across these eight carbons. And what we typically do is we typically cartoon it this way. We make it look like the boron has a parachute. And the name of this molecule is 9-boro-bicyclo. And then we include the numbers 3.3.1 nonane. And we pick up 9BBN. That's the abbreviation that's used for it, 9BBN. This now is a reagent that has huge sterics and will hydroborate based on its sterics alone. So now what we can do is we can take the same reaction that we were doing before, where we were only getting 57%. And we can now look at this reaction, what we can do with the steric reagent and how it can react with this, and we'll get 99.8%. So what we see when we do this reaction now is that if we take that same molecule that we were reacting before, and we do number one, 9-BBN, and we do 2 hydroboration oxidation, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. What we find is that we get now the alcohol on this position, and we get it in 99.8% yield. And it's functioning because of the sterics, because the boron is trying desperately to avoid the sterics of this other group on the other side. So even though these are both secondary positions, a secondary carbon and a secondary carbon, this thing is working by sterics, and the boron is winding up on the less sterically hindered side. And then the hydroxyl ends up on the less sterically hindered side. And that's how the reaction works. So there's some other questions that we could ask here. We could ask about the stereoselectivity. So we've shown what we've been discussing is we've been discussing regioselectivity. So maybe we should define a couple of things here. Regioselectivity. This is where the reaction is selective for for a position in the molecule. So in other words, when we look at hydroboration in the way that we've done hydroboration, and we've thought about the R group here, and we take BH3THF, and then number two, we do the oxidation. This is regioselectivity. This is demonstrating high regioselectivity, so that the hydroxyl group ends up here. This is regioselective. The 9-BDN reaction that we just looked at up above, this is regioselective. Now what I want to look at is I want to look at stereoselective. What is stereoselectivity? That means that the reaction is selective for one stereoisomer over another. Now, when we say stereoisomer, we mean diastereomers. So the reaction is selective for one stereoisomer or diastereomer over another. When we get to enantioselective, that's where we're selective for one enantiomer over another. Okay, so we're not quite there yet. We're in stepwise. So these are diastereomers that we're talking about right now. Okay, so in order to investigate stereoselectivity, what we need to do is we need to ask what happens when we do something like this. Let's pick an easy molecule that we can look at with the double bond, and we'll put a methyl group there. What happens when we do this reaction? And let's track it. We'll do BH3THF. This will be the same with 9-BDN. It doesn't matter if we do it with 9-BDN or if we do it with BH3, because this one has a difference. One is a secondary center, one's a tertiary center. We'll do the oxidation, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide and water. And let's see what happens as we go through and do the reaction. So first off, what we'll do is we'll take a look and we'll note that there is a tertiary center and a secondary center. So we know that we're going to want the partial positive to develop on that tertiary center, which means the boron is going to go to the other location. So when we go through the hydroboration, let's do this flat. Let's take it and we'll make the double bond as if the double bond were flat and sort of facing towards us. There's the methyl group. And the BH3, what we'll do is we'll have this come from the top face of the molecule. There's also a hydrogen that's here. So I'll leave that one in. And what we'll do is we'll track the hydrogens attached to the boron by tracking them in blue. Electrons are going to swing out and grab the boron. The boron's electrons in the hydrogen bond are going to go to the carbon. And this happens simultaneously. It's a concerted mechanism. Concerted, but asymmetric. Such that the transition state, when I look at it, The transition state has the bond making happening ahead of the bond making on this side, such that I am getting that buildup. Of partial charge there. So I'm getting build up a partial positive, build up a partial minus, and tracking those hydrogens and where they're going. This is our transition state. And what they're doing is we're noticing that the boron, come on, little pointer, there it is, the boron and the hydrogen are coming from the same side of the molecule. This is what is called a syn addition. The boron and hydrogen add from the same side. Not all reagents do this. Many reagents will add from one side and the other side, but this one adds from the same side. So what that means is that when this transition state is done and I'm looking at this flat bond, now what I've got is I've got the boron, which is on the top side of the molecule with the two hydrogens on it, the hydrogen, which is on the top side of the molecule, the methyl group, which is down, and this hydrogen, which is down, and the boron and the hydrogen that came from the boron have added to the same face. That's what a syn addition is. And then when it goes through and we do the oxidation, the transfer of oxidation is with retention of configuration. That's a key step. So as this thing goes through and does the oxidation is with retention of configuration, such that when I look at kind of make this a little bit bigger this way, that's a little bit better. Such that when I do this, the oxygen that came in and the hydrogen stay on the same face. And let's say that this guy is the one that came in here from the boron, that those guys came on the same face. And so if I wanted to draw this in a slightly different way, the way that I would draw it is to say that the hydroxyl group is up and the methyl group that was here is down. And that is the only isomer that I get it's enantiomer. So it is plus minus. It is racemic because that can happen from the top face just as equally as it can happen from the bottom face. But what's important is the location of this hydroxyl group and the methyl that, or the hydrogen that came in at the same time with it. So that hydrogen is here and those guys are on the same face. And that is the syn addition. And that is what is called stereoselective. So this reaction is stereoselective. So in other words, hydroboration is both regioselective and stereoselective. So that's the really key thing about the hydroboration. So hydroboration oxidation, it is both regioselective and stereoselective. When we look at BH3.THF and we do it with number one, number two, the oxidation, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water, This reagent is guided by electronics. And so this is putting the boron on the less substituted carbon. And then when we look at the other reagent that we looked at, which is 9-BBN, same oxidation works for both. And water. This reagent is both electronic and sterics, but it's used more for sterics. This one is really guided. Apple pin decided to freak out. They're guided by sterics, where the boron goes to the less sterically hindered side. And so those are the hydroboration oxidation reactions with BH3THF and 9-BBN. And so what that has done is that has given us now the ability to be able to take this double bond and to say that if I want to react this double bond, we just put an R group out here. I want to react this double bond with HX. When I do so, it's going to react in such a way that the X group is going to fall here and the hydrogen is going to fall here. If I want to do it without shifts, and this is going to go through carbocation and shifts are possible. So watch out for shifts. If I do this one with mercury acetate, pencil failing here. There we go. Nibbles loose OAC2. And then we put in sodium X. And then I do two, the hydroboration, it's not actually hydroboration, it's really a reduction with sodium borohydride. That's why I'm having trouble here. NaBH4. What this does is this will give me the exact same thing, but I won't get any shifts. So this one really has no C plus. It doesn't go through the carbocation. It goes through the cyclic mercurium ion. And this one has no shifts. It prevents the shifts from occurring so that I can select what I want. And now we've got another one to be able to add to this. And this is where I do one BH3THF and two, we've got the oxidation, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And this allows us to be able to take and put a hydroxyl group out here and the hydrogen on the other side. And this is a syn addition, so that they come from the same side, the hydrogen and the oxygen. And that's an important component within that reaction. Additionally to this, we did see where we used an acid and water. So we could use something like H2SO4 and water, and we can react this and go through the carbocation and be able to get to the alcohol here if we wanted to instead of a halogen. This had C plus and shifts were possible. And so there's three reactions that we've looked at of all different kinds of things that we could do to that double bond, getting different sorts of reagents. Lots of interesting chemistry there. And so one of the reasons that I like to go through the hyperboration so much that is kind of fun to think about is that my mentor, Bakhtan Singaram, was working with H.C. Brown at the time that he earned the Nobel Prize. And he was a postdoc student of H.C. Brown's. And so I'm sort of like an H.C. Brown grandson, if you think about it in that way, in academic lineage. So you've got H.C. Brown to Bakhtan Singaram to Jason Camera to now you guys. So you guys are like H.C. Brown great-grandchildren. And it's a way of thinking about organic chemistry. It's a thought process that when we track academic lineages, it's not so much necessarily the work that people do, but the thinking that they pass on and the way that they think about organic chemistry and the way that they think about a problem. And what Bakhtan taught me and what H.C. Brown taught him is that the way that you discover new reactions and things within organic chemistry is to watch for things like this and to question when you see a reaction and a reaction gives you a small percentage difference in products, to ask the question, why did it give a small difference? And then how can I accentuate that difference? How can I make that difference not just giving 3% excess, but push it all the way to 100% excess? And if I understand the reaction enough, and if I look at it and see what Mother Nature is telling me, and I listen to all those little clues that Mother Nature is telling me, that I can find a way to gain control over that reaction, and I can push it one direction or the other direction. And that's what's this thinking that H.C. Brown did in almost all the reactions that he ever did. That's what he was looking at, was how do I take a small percentage and turn it into a large percentage by understanding the reaction mechanism and by understanding how to gain control over it and using sterics or using electronics or using whatever tools that we have that we've already studied to be able to push that reaction one direction or another. So that's why I like the hydroboration oxidation reaction so much, is it really goes back to a way of thinking about organic chemistry that is how I was taught about organic chemistry and looking at the different ways to gain control over it. All right, so these are all in the realm of electrophilic addition. And we have a lot more electrophilic addition reactions to do. There are all kinds of ones here that we're just simply not gonna have time to look at yet. And so I'm not gonna try to push that in just this last week because there's so many more to go through that I'm thinking what I'm going to do is I'm going to end it pretty much at the hydroboration oxidation. There's one more that I'd like to get in there, but it pushes it a little bit. And it has to do with how do we get, and maybe I'll just say it because it's kind of fun to look at. X here was a halogen, and we were getting these halogens in the more substituted carbon going towards the carbocation where the carbocation is. And then we looked at how we could change that reactivity with a hydroxyl group. But is there a way that we could put the halogen on the less substituted one? There is a way that we can convert hydroxyl groups into halogens. But is there a way that we can do it directly? And it turns out there actually is a way that we can do it directly. And it happens by using a different reaction mechanism. How much time do I have? I have 10 minutes left. It's like, how could I not do this in 10 minutes? Because you can totally do it in 10 minutes. It doesn't take that long to do. So maybe just this one last one and then we'll cut it. When I take and look at doing the addition of HBr, and I do this in a solvent, say acetic acid, what I get is what I expect. I get the bromide going in this position. And the reason that that reaction works in the way that it does, everything that we've learned already, we reach out, we grab the proton, we form the carbocation, we get the most stable carbocation, the hydrogen attaches here, and the bromide comes in and binds to the carbocation to give us the more substituted component. And this is 90% roughly of the product that we get. The other 10% might be a little bit of this guy, might be some other things that happen in there. But that major component is going through the carbocation in a more stable position. When we take this reaction and we change one thing, we do HBr, but we add into it peroxide. Now, peroxide is not generally hydrogen peroxide. What we generally add in is organic peroxide. We generally add ROOR. And this is an organic peroxide. The organic peroxide changes the reactivity and puts the bromide on the primary position, and we get like 95% of that guy, and we only get 5% of this one. So the question is, what is going on here? Why did that change the reactivity? What is the organic peroxide doing? The organic peroxide, when I look at that, it's actually a free radical generator. So what is a free radical? A free radical is a molecule that has only one electron. When light comes in and strikes this molecule, it breaks it, and it breaks it homolytically, and it makes two free radicals. So the oxygen had two lone pairs, each oxygen. When we broke the bond homolytically, the oxygen has the two lone pairs, and then it has the free radical. So I end up with two equivalents of this free radical. Free radicals are extremely reactive. They react with all different kinds of things. One of the things that they will do is very quickly react with acids. And the free radical will react with the acid to take the proton from the HBr. But it reacts in a free radical manner, producing bromide radical. So this now makes an equivalent of alcohol. And what I get is I get bromine free radical, which now has the one valence electron. That thing turns around and reacts with the double bond. When it reacts with the double bond, it reacts this way. It reacts in a free radical mechanism. So the double bond breaks and electrons go to the bromide to make a bond with the bromide, and one electron goes onto the carbon. So it makes a bromide carbon bond, and it makes a carbon free radical. Now the question is, it could make two different free radicals. It could make that free radical that I just drew, where the free radical is on the more substituted carbon, or it could have gone the other direction. It could have gone this way and made this guy. Now the question is, which free radical is more stable? Well, when you look at free radicals, and we look at a carbon-free radical, it turns out that a carbon-free radical is identical in structure to a carbocation, and that they have all the same stability properties, that they are both sp2 hybridized, and that they are very similar. Being so similar, everything that stabilizes a carbocation also stabilizes a free radical. More substitution, resonance, all of those things contribute to stabilizing a free radical, which means that the secondary free radical is more stable. This one being a primary free radical is less stable. So all the reactivity is going through this more stable secondary free radical. And then that free radical in turn grabs a proton, and it grabs a proton from HBr, which just generates more bromide free radical. Gotta watch that I use the right arrows. Gotta use Fishhook arrows for free radicals. And that guy then becomes this. And we've generated another free radical, which goes back into the chain and keeps on going. And this is the major product. So when we look at the free radical reaction, what's beautiful about it is that in the free radical reaction, the hydrogen doesn't add first. In the free radical reaction, the bromide adds first. And because the bromine adds first, it allows the more stable free radical to then grab the proton, and the proton adds second. And that's why it changes all of the reactivity. And so now when I come back up here to this diagram that I've been creating, I absolutely can get the opposite of these guys here. What I can do is I can use HX with free radical, with peroxide. And that allows me to be able to put the X out here and the hydrogen here. And this is a free radical reaction. Which changes the reactivity and pushes it the other direction. Okay, that's as far as I'll go. I'm looking at the time, it's 12:29. I hit that 12:30 mark exactly where I wanted to, which is really kind of fun. And so we have added not quite half the reactions. I'd still say there's more than half the reactions that we have to cover yet, but I'm gonna leave those until the next semester, and this is where I'm gonna cut it. So the next lecture, what I'll do is I'll just wrap things up and go through a review and kind of look at what I expect to be on the test and how that's gonna be handled. And we'll cut it at these reactions that are the first reactions that we would cover in the alkene chapter. So super cool chemistry and a lot more interesting chemistry to come. A lot of these reactions are looking at what we can do to control the regioselectivity of the reaction with the alkene. And then we have a couple of other reactions of fun things that we can do with alkenes. And then the question is, well, where are we going with all of this? Why do we do all of these reactions with alkenes? These reactions, as we study each one of them, are tools in a toolbox that are going to allow us to be able to take a synthetic target and be able to build a molecule, a synthetic target, starting with very simple materials, and use these reactions one after another to build a larger, more complicated molecule that we can use for drug synthesis, that we can use for material design, that we can use for any number of purposes. It allows us to be able to not just study chemical reactions and predict what's going to happen, but control what's going to happen and be able to make different molecules for many different purposes. As I said, some of those are for medications, some of those are for material science, all different types of things, but we can control the chemistry, each one of these being a tool in the toolbox that we can reach for as need be, in order to be able to control and synthesize molecules. And that's really where the fun part starts, is where we start looking at how do we synthesize, or how do we make something? Because not everything that we want can be isolated from nature. A lot of times when we want to make a medication, or we find a molecule that can be used as a medication, that molecule may be located in very small quantities within maybe a tree or a plant or something, that if we were to try to harvest it from nature, we would have to deforest entire forests in order to gain enough of that molecule to be able to treat diseases in the human population. And so instead of doing that, we find those molecules, we learn about those molecules, but then we learn to synthesize those molecules and make them from simpler starting materials. And that's the goal of where we're actually going with all of this, is to be able to synthesize larger molecules. And all of these just become simple tools. All right, that's sort of an overview. I'm gonna cut it there, get this recording up for you guys. And I'll do some more work in the Canvas shell, and we'll see where we're at. All right, thanks for watching.